couple days ago, I had somebody send me an email, and they said, boy, I wish you were here. They were getting their car serviced at a dealership in town, and they noted that there was a little Bible study taking place, and the people who were there were talking about end times. And I said, well, have them invite me over. So anyway, so far that hasn't happened yet. But in my mind, that is a good illustration of how, as you go through life, you're going to find some people who want to talk about end time events. And their focus for the end time event may be differ, this group from that group. But if you listen to them, if you study with them, as we talked about last week, chances are Acts 15, verses 15 through 18 may come up. Ideally, we'd have a full class just to concentrate on that. We have, because of the break, we've had to put that into two separate classes, some last week, some today. So there's really no way to kind of go back and put the genie back in the bottle, so to speak. So I want to cover just a little bit of what we looked at and then try to broaden your horizons a little bit and maybe show you some things that you've not yet considered, especially as you look at some old things relative to the law of Moses. Let's start with the text. Acts 15, starting with 15. And to this the words of the prophets, as it is written, he says, they agree. After these things I will return, and I will build up again the tabernacle of David, which is fallen, and I will build again the ruins thereof, and I will set it up, that the residue of men may seek after the Lord, and all the Gentiles, key word, all the Gentiles upon whom my name is called, saith the Lord, who maketh these things known from old. Before we get into the text, let me make one practical point of application. Today's world, if you do anything on social media like Facebook, that may be the most prominent example. You have a religious question comes up. Somebody says, well, what do you believe? Or what's the right idea about this? And people will start posting a lot of different opinions. If you involve yourself in that kind of thing, there's going to be a lot of opinion swapping back and forth. Or somebody comes up at work and says, well, what do you believe about this? And this guy's going to say, well, I think. This guy says, well, I believe. Or this is what our church says. What's the best way? And you have the example, the answer in here, Acts chapter 15. What's the best way to deal with those kinds of situations?
Say the Bible.
All right. Just either point to it or read it. And you don't have to say anything more. That's what James did. He said, this is what it's written, back there in Amos chapter 9, to this, that is the situation, the words of the prophet agree. He thought that was suitable. He didn't have to go on with a long, drawn-out explanation. Sometimes, oftentimes, the most powerful response that you can give in any of those settings is simply to put the word before people. Now, if you do that, you're going to hear, well, yeah, but, well, that's fine. But you have still laid that out, and that's going to likely be the strongest argument that you can make in many cases, and certainly it is right. Let's go back and talk about the tabernacle again from Amos chapter 9. One of the things that I didn't tell you last week, when he talks about this tabernacle, you might expect that it would be the tabernacle of who?
David.
Well, that's what he says. But you might expect it to be the tabernacle of Moses, right? He's the guy that goes out there and gets that started. But that's not what he talks about. He says it's the tabernacle of David. Well, then he says something else. David, what was David hoping to do? What was going to be, you know, David was going to be the Donald Trump of his time, right? What was he going to do?
Build a temple.
All right, David is going to build this temple. Why would you build a temple if you got the tabernacle? What's the tabernacle?
Tent.
It's the tent. It's the portable structure. It's the thing that's not going to last. You want the temple. But that's, again, not the focus. David is the focus along with the tabernacle. And that just seems very, very curious. I'm going to give you some more information that will add to the curiosity level, but let me make a couple of additional points beyond that. When he says that that's in ruins and that's fallen, Amos uses slightly different information back in Amos chapter 9 and verse 12 to make the same point. Here in Acts chapter 15, those are expressed with a perfect tense. That's been fallen, it's in ruins, and he says that was the ongoing state. When you start looking at the word tabernacle, I told you last week, it's used about 150 times. Or, I'm sorry. I've got a couple figures here. I want to make sure that I give you the correct information. Let me go back and take a look at that. Yeah, 150 times in the New Testament. Here's what I didn't tell you. Anybody want to take a stab at how many chapters in the Bible you can turn to and read about the tabernacle?
The whole Bible.
Well, that would probably be a little strong, but...
No. I'm asking, are you talking
about... Oh, yeah, the whole Bible.
New and Old.
Yeah, New and Old. Sorry, didn't understand the question. Anybody want to take a stab?
50.
You're close. 45 plus. Now let that sink in for a second. Remember, the temple is the big deal in the Old Testament, right? I mean, that's everything for the Jews. But when you go back and look at the tabernacle, mentioned 150 times and in 45 plus chapters. Now, 45 chapters, that's a lot more than a lot of Bible books. So when I start thinking about all the stuff there in the board, emphasis is with David, the tabernacle, mentioned 150 times, 45 plus chapters, I'm beginning to think there's got to be something more going on here. Well, there is, and we want to go ahead and make that point. One other thing that I wanted to recover from last week, and this was kind of related to Don's question, remember that the restoration of David's tabernacle was going to be joined to something. Only this could occur after this was done. What needed to occur? Anybody remember? The Gentiles? All right. The Gentiles are going to be saved. That's the whole discussion in Acts chapter 15, isn't it? Remember the false teachers? They're creating the problem. Everybody goes down to Jerusalem. They have this big meeting. And now James, to say that the Gentiles can be saved just like the Jews, what's he do? He goes back and he starts talking about David's tabernacle. The Gentiles are going to be saved when David's tabernacle has been restored. Well, if David's tabernacle has not been restored, and that is the view of some people today, then what must be true for the Gentiles?
They're not saved.
They're not saved. But if Gentiles are saved today, then what must be true? David's tabernacle has been restored. Well, if David's tabernacle has been restored, then you're asking the question, when was the restoration? Or how was the restoration fulfilled? Well, that's a really good question. And that brings us to where we want to really begin today. Got some numbers for you. And the numbers, I'm not going to go back. Well, yeah. Go ahead.
The tabernacle housed the Ark of the Covenant.
Yes.
Correct?
Yes.
In fact, that's one of the reasons they built it. And Jesus, the tabernacle represents Jesus coming back, and he represents the new covenant. Is there any correlation there?
Yeah, that's kind of... Let me switch some things around that I was going to do. Last week, and I threw this in at the last minute, I had a hurried reading of 2 Samuel chapter 6. Remember how that chapter starts? You got the information in there about Uzzah. You know, he touches the what? Ark. What happens to him? He dies. And that's, for the most part, I think, where a lot of people start and stop. But I tried to read through that chapter to show you just how enthusiastic David was. Now, there's more to the story, and we didn't get there last week, but we're going to get there this week. As we head over to the book of 1 Chronicles. You've got 1 Chronicles 13, which that's really good to read in conjunction with Acts 15, and you're not going to be overburdened by names there. You can skip 1 Chronicles 14. But then, as you turn over to 1 Chronicles 15 and 1 Chronicles 16, you've still got that information about David and the Ark and the tabernacle. And basically what happens is, David decides that he wants to take the tabernacle to Jerusalem. And he does. And it is a big event. And you have thousands of priests involved in worship as you go back there and you look at the information in Chronicles. And it is this huge, huge celebration. It is this big, big deal. In fact, you'd almost think that this was something that was going to be associated with the temple. But it wasn't. It was with the tabernacle. I want to go back, and as a class, let's take a look at 1 Chronicles 16. I'm going to start with verse 23. And read down through verse 26. Now, if we had more time, I'd go back and start with 1 Chronicles 13 and skip 14. 14, you could read 14, and also go through all of 15 and go through all of 16. But bear in mind, the first part of 1 Chronicles 16, you know, again, they've got the tabernacle, it's headed in the right way, and David gets over to the area of Jerusalem, and you've got all of this stuff taking place. Notice how David is beginning to respond. Starting with 23, sing unto Jehovah, how much? All the earth. Show forth his salvation from day to day. Declare his glory where? Among the nations. Ah, something's going on there. Not just the Jews, that's plural. His marvelous works among who? All the peoples. For great is Jehovah and greatly to be praised. He also is to be feared above all gods. For all the gods of the peoples are idols, but Jehovah made the heavens. Honor and majesty are before him. Strength and gladness are in his place. Ascribe unto Jehovah, ye kindreds of the peoples. There's the idea again. Ascribe unto Jehovah glory and strength. Ascribe unto Jehovah the glory due unto his name. Bring an offering. Come before him. Worship Jehovah in holy array. Tremble before him, all the earth. The world is established that it cannot be moved. Let the heavens be glad. Let the earth rejoice. Let them say among the nations, Jehovah reigneth. Let the sea roar, the fullness thereof. Let the field exult, and all that is in therein. Then shall the trees of the woods sing for the joy before Jehovah, for he cometh to judge the earth. O give thanks unto Jehovah, for he is good, for his loving kindness endureth forever. And he and say ye, save us, O God, of our salvation, and gather us together and deliver us from the nations to give thanks unto thy holy name and to triumph in thy praise. Then finally, 36. Blessed be Jehovah, the God of Israel, from everlasting even unto everlasting. And the people said, Amen. If you'll think back to either what you know or read quickly last week, 2 Samuel chapter 6, you remember the lady that sees David and makes fun of him? David, you're acting like a fool. You're acting like a crazy man. David is worked up. When it comes to this tabernacle coming back to Jerusalem and all this stuff taking place, David is beyond enthused. That attitude sounds a little bit like a New Testament attitude, doesn't it? John 4, woman at Samaria, Jesus said the true worshipers are going to worship God in spirit. Well, doesn't that sound a lot like David's attitude in 1 Chronicles chapter 16? I mean, this guy is enthused. This guy is on fire. This guy is passionate. This fella is worked up because of the ark. Spirit and truth. David, you begin to see with that tabernacle radical behavior. And I'm suggesting, and I'm going to give you some more evidence for this as we move along, that radical behavior was designed to suggest something else radical is going to take place in the future. We've already talked about, and I think that you have to include this as far as David's dynasty when it talks about the tabernacle of David being raised up. Certainly, Jesus was going to come, and he was going to be part of that as well. But you also have some other things. Let's just leave that up on the right side and go back here. Well, let's just clear it all. How many directions do we have? We've got four. If you were to go back to the book of Numbers, the second chapter, you'd read about the four directions. North, south, east, and west. And you've got Israel in camp around the tabernacle. Now again, remember what the tabernacle is. The tabernacle is not the ark. The tabernacle is just this tent, this portable structure. So if you were to go back, you'd find that on the east, you've got 186,400 people. On the west, you've got 108,000, and then another 100 beyond that. Over on the north side, you have there 157,000 plus another 600. And then, I'll make sure I got my numbers right, 180. On the south side, be about 151,000 plus 450. Now, let's in our minds, and I'm going to put this on the board as well. We've got this tabernacle with this number of people on the four sides. Let's say that we're going to stand the tabernacle up. We're going to go from the rectangular, we're going to put it upright. If you were to do that, of these four directions, which one would you put at the bottom?
East.
All right, we would start with the biggest. So that's the east. I'm just going to put 186,000 there. Okay, now if we want our shape to be, you know, fairly symmetrical, we've got, since let's just block off the east here, we've got three choices left. If we kind of wanted to put maybe, you know, a side that would sort of be equal, what do you think we should put on our sides?
150s.
All right, so yeah, let's take the north. We're at 157 there plus. And we're going to cross it off. And let's put the south over here. And we've got 151 plus. So we've got our north, and we've got our south, and we've got our east. So that only leaves us with the west. Well, that's kind of an interesting configuration and almost looks like a compass. But let's make that a little more interesting. Let's suppose that we go ahead and just draw that out some. Let's suppose that we go ahead... Guess what? The tabernacle pointing to the cross of Christ. God said, I want you people positioned, and that is exactly how it lines up. But it gets a little more interesting. Let's change our picture of the tabernacle. Now, we've probably seen this as far as some pictures. Here you've got the tabernacle. All right, you've got the Holy of Holies, and let's go ahead and start at what I'm going to refer to as the top. What do you have at the top? Holy of Holies. What do you have in there? You've got the Ark, Cherubim, the Mercy Seat, and so forth. All right, you move down a little bit, and then you've got the Altar of Incense. And then, almost off to the side, you've got the Candlestick, you got the Table of Showbread, and then you've got the brazen altar and the laver. On the inside of the ark as well, or the inside of the tabernacle, you also see the cross. You have to begin to ask the question, were those designs intentional, or were those designs just the way it happened to line up? Obviously, we do have four directions. Obviously, from Numbers chapter 2, you have to say that with those numbers, if you flip things up, you can make a perfect cross. Well, all those things are at least suggestive. I think I want a little more information, and in fact, I think that we do have that. Remember what we had earlier on the board? How many passages about the tabernacle? 150. That's a bunch. And that's enough to throw up a red flag to say you really probably want to take a close look at that. And then how many chapters in the Bible on the tabernacle? 45 plus. Once again, and you contrast that with all the information that is said about the temple, you really have to start taking a look and saying, okay, something big is going on with the tabernacle. Now, I'm not going to give you everything about the tabernacle. We're one day, hopefully, Lord willing, going to get back to the book of Exodus on Sunday nights. And assuming that we do that, and that is my plan, at some point I want to start going through the tabernacle. And when you start unfolding, you have a couple of special guys associated with the tabernacle, and when you go back and you look at what their names meant, I mean, you just begin to see Christ, the cross, and the church in the tabernacle. And it's just amazing. A lot of times with the kinds of prophecies that you have in Acts chapter 15, emphasis is on the church, the kingdom of God, the here and now. But a lot of people miss that. So, Don, we're not completely quite through with the question that you asked, but I do want to make some other points. Now, let's take all that information. Well, let's leave it on the board, I guess. And think about what we sort of highlighted quickly last week. You remember from Ephesians chapter 2, verses 20 and 22, Paul said, God is now, there was this mystery, Ephesians 3, and he says, now God has made known the mystery. He's got this spiritual house that he's building. Ephesians chapter 2, verses 20 and 22. Tabernacle was a portable secular structure. The church is a spiritual ongoing structure. And then we tied in what Peter had to say in 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 5. If you don't look at Peter's statement in view of other information in Scripture, you're probably going to say, well, that's kind of interesting, but it doesn't really seem to relate to anything. But Peter talked about building material, didn't he? He said, you are what? You are stones. Remember that? And not only did he say you're stones, what you're what kind of stones? You are living stones to be built up as what? A holy priesthood. You are that spiritual house to offer sacrifices unto God. That was done in the temple, or in the tabernacle, excuse me, in the temple as well. And now we see it being done in the church. What else do I want to tell you? I made the connection between that and Revelation chapter 21, verses 1 through 3 as well. Let's go back and look at, well, anything that you want to add or ask before I start making some parallels. I probably should pause for a minute. Okay, let's go back and start thinking about how the tabernacle slash Ark of the Covenant is related to the New Testament. Certainly the tabernacle was important because it housed the Ark, but when you think about what was in the tabernacle, the Ark is the prominent item back there in the whole of Holy of Holies. So I want to start back in the book of Exodus. Let's go back to Exodus chapter 25. We'll look at verse 8, also verses 21 and 22, and contrast that or compare that with what we have over in 2 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 16. Let's get two readers lined up. The first is Exodus 25, starting with verse 8. That'll be Gary. Steve, you want to be our 2 Corinthians 6 reader? 2 Corinthians 6, verse 16. Gary, if you'll start with Exodus chapter 25 and verse 8.
And let them make me a sanctuary that I may dwell among them.
Okay. So when we start thinking about the tabernacle, God says, I want this to do what? I want it so I can dwell among my people. Okay, that's fair enough. Let's take a look a little further in the chapter, Gary, 21 and 22.
And thou shalt put the mercy seat above upon the ark, and in the ark thou shalt put the testimony that I shall give thee. And there I will meet with thee, and I will commune with thee from above the mercy seat, from between the two cherubims which are upon the ark of the testimony, of all things which I will give thee in the commandment unto the children of Israel.
Very good, and thank you. So two more key words there from that Exodus 25 reading. God says, this is going to be a place where I am going to dwell. This is going to be a place where I'm going to meet you. And this is going to be a place where I commune. If we were just reading through the Old Testament, we would say, well, okay, that's pretty clear as far as why the tabernacle was given. No big deal. Let's continue to read. If you were a first century person, though, perhaps a Jew, and I can almost imagine Paul and some of the other first century preachers, they would say, let's start over there in the book of Exodus. And we've got the tabernacle and the ark, and the Jews say, well, yes, we believe that. And Paul says, let me show you what that pointed forward to. Steve, 2 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 16.
And what agreement has the temple of God with idols? For you are the temple of the living God, as God has said, I will dwell in them and walk among them. I will be their God, and they shall be my people.
Notice that. Old Testament tabernacle, I'm going to dwell, I'm going to meet you there, I'm going to commune with you there. Paul said, you who? The church. What's true for you?
You're the temple.
You're my temple. And what's going to happen? I'm going to dwell among you. This was great. It pointed to this. Now, as a footnote, let me make a couple of additional points. When you go back and you look at the tabernacle, how serious was God about building it and not messing it up?
Very.
I mean, he gave detailed instructions. This is what I want from you. And that was pretty clear. Now, would you say that the tabernacle was the inferior or the church was the inferior? Was the church the superior or the tabernacle was the superior? The church was superior. Now, if this is the inferior, and this is what God says don't mess with, this is what I'm telling you to do, no addition, no subtraction. If that's true for the lesser, then what's true for the greater?
Superior.
and even more so. Yet when you look at people today and they have their ideas about the church, if they understood what was taking place with the tabernacle and how it was the lesser and how we now have the greater, and they think that they can somehow tear the church asunder or do various things to it, I think they'd radically change your view. But a lot of the problems that we have, I think, relative to the word church now in people is that they simply don't consider what you have back there in the Old Testament. So that's just one of numerous comparisons. And like I say, I'm only going to give a few today, but a lot more could be given. Anything that you want to add or ask about that before we move down a little further? Glenda?
Was the Ark of the Covenant still in the temple when Jesus died on the cross?
We're not told when the Ark disappeared, but I'm glad you brought that up because that creates another interesting point for us. Putting this in terms of where we just were. Focus in the Old Testament on the tabernacle and on the ark. Once again, is this the lesser or is this the greater? This is the lesser. So if this is the lesser, where does God want people to focus?
On the church.
Now, if God wants people to focus on the church, what would then be true for the focus here? All right, we want to draw you away from this, so you're going to focus on this. What happens if God would allow that ark to be found?
The focus would go there.
Exactly right. So this is a human reasoning, if you will. But when you look at it from that perspective, as far as what the tabernacle pointed to, as far as the church is here, and that's where, I mean, that's where we're in a right relationship with God. I'm persuaded that God took the ark out of the way. When you look at the ark, it looks like with the captivity after the Jews, 586, the Babylonians, the ark just disappeared. And I think when you look at that time-wise, Glenda, 500 years, the ark has been out of the picture. Why? Because God says, I'm going to give you a little bit of a break. The church is coming, and I don't want you to go back here. These were kind of the baby steps. You're in adulthood now, and you don't want to go back to baby food. Now, that's a powerful lesson, and that's a simple lesson, but getting people in the religious world to see that seems to be complicated for some reason. Anything, again, you want to add or ask? Betty?
At Christ's death, wasn't the veil of the temple between the holy holies and the holy place?
Yes.
Split in two?
Yes.
So you're saying even though that happened, the ark is probably not in the holy place?
I don't think the ark was in there at the time. Like I say, the last information that we seem to have about the ark is about 500 to 600 years before Jesus came into the world.
Then why did they have that was the whole part of the Holy of Holies. You know, and these priests were to go there and to offer and once a year, but so they're going back there to nothing?
Well, remember, the temple was rebuilt.
Yeah.
You've got to make do with what you have.
So when Jerusalem was destroyed, do you think the ark was destroyed at that time?
Well, remember, Jerusalem was destroyed about 70 AD. If we back up about 600 years prior to that time, my thinking is the ark disappeared about 500 years before Jesus came to the earth. Temple's rebuilt, and no ark. Okay, let's pick up the next one. Let's take a look at 1 Samuel chapter 6 and verse 19, and we'll also back you up to 1 Samuel chapter 5, verses 1 through 4. I really prefer the 1 Samuel 5 reference. I think that's stronger, but still, 1 Samuel 6, 19 is a good beginning point. Who wants to take that one for us? 1 Samuel 6 and 1 Samuel 5. 1 Samuel 6, 19. Bonnie? Okay, the ark was certainly a blessing to God's people, but if it got misused, 1 Samuel chapter 6 and verse 19, not such a good thing. If you read that story in isolation, you say, well, okay, maybe we can draw some application out of that. But if you look at that in terms of what we have on the board, ark, covenant, Christ, church, you begin to see a parallel to Jesus. And I say, as I say, this one may not be the easiest one to see, but Christ, just like the ark, that system of worship, it was a blessing if used correctly. Same thing is true for Jesus. But you head off with Jesus in the wrong way, and that is bad news. Bonnie, if you'll skip over to that next passage we had, 1 Samuel chapter 5, verses 1 through 4. This one, I think, is a little stronger to see.
And the Philistines took the ark of God and brought it from Ebenezer unto Ashdod. When the Philistines took the ark of God, they brought it into the house of Dagon and set it by Dagon. And when they of Ashdod arose early on the morrow, behold, Dagon was fallen upon his face to the earth before the ark of the Lord.
Thank you. What was Dagon? All right, idol, pagan god. The ark is brought into the presence of Dagon. What happens to Dagon? All right, it basically, it doesn't destroy him, but I mean, it certainly kind of takes him apart. You remember Matthew 15 and verse 13? Every plant which my heavenly Father planted not shall be rooted up. There's a parallel between the two. Now, it's really easy to look at 1 Samuel chapter 5 by itself and Matthew 15, 13 by itself. But when you start seeing the connection between the tabernacle, the ark, Christ, the church, all of a sudden you can start connecting these passages and you begin to think, huh, there's a reason for that. All right, let's talk about what Glenda was mentioning a bit ago and Betty as well. Think about the ark. Where is it today? Now, we don't know. It's disappeared. What's true for Jesus? His presence, his blessings abide how long? Forever. 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 3 through 4. So, temporary, inferior, ongoing, superior. Again and again, there is this contrast in Scripture. And as you start studying this out, you begin to see, I mean, there's just one right after the other. Okay, do you remember back in Joshua chapter 6, verses 12 through 20, and we're not going to read that, but that's the story of the bringing down of Jericho. What features prominently into that story? Anybody remember? Didn't they have the ark at Jericho? All right, they carried the ark. We've got the ark, and what happens to the bad guys? They're overcome. Well, guess what? The church, Jesus shows up, and what happens? The bad guys are overcome, right? Demons are cast out. Jesus frees us from the power of death, sin, Satan. The Lord expelled demons. It's one more example of, you can look at that story of Jericho and say, that is a great story. Love to teach that in the Bible class. It's something that the kids love, and it is a wonderful story. But the fall of Jericho, the ark is mentioned for a specific reason. It was pointing forward to the thing that we're talking about. Here's another one. Joshua chapter 3, starting with verse 7. Time for Israel to go into the promised land. But what do they have? Here's Canaan over here. What do they got to cross? All right, they got to cross the river. Well, guess what was present?
Carry the ark.
They carry the ark. What did the ark do? Anybody remember what happened to the water?
The water got dried up.
All right, the water was opened up, so they've got a path. They've got a path to Canaan with the ark. Well, guess what? Who shows up? Jesus does. What does Jesus say? I am the way, the truth, and the life. Now you go back to Joshua chapter 3 and say, that's a wonderful story. It is. But it was pointing forward to what we see. There are some other things. Do you remember that golden pot of manna? Hebrews chapter 9 and verse 4, Aaron's rod that budded. What do we find in John chapter 6? Not a golden pot with manna. Jesus says, I am the bread of life. Well, how amazing. You also have some other things. People have made different suggestions about the budding of the rod. Some have thought that that points to Jesus being the fountain for eternal life. Maybe that's correct. Maybe not. You think about some other things here. The wood. Let's go back and take a look at that for a second as well. Exodus chapter 25 and verse 8. Depending on your translation, you'll have different renderings here. In the ASV, you will find the word acacia wood. I thought that was Exodus 25:8. There's a sanctuary. Was it 18? I think I...
10.
Is it 10? Okay. Yeah, thank you very much. And they shall make an ark of acacia wood. You may have different words. When you look at acacia wood, if you do some research about that, you'll find that that was, out of all the woods in that area, you got a desert area, and of all the woods, acacia was the most common. Why pick that kind of wood? You probably could have found other woods which would have been maybe more attractive. Acacia is certainly not an ugly wood if you pull up some pictures of it. But you think about this wood. God says this ark. I want you to make the ark. And it was overlaid with gold. We'll make a second point about that in a second. But I want you to make this ark out of a wood which is everywhere. The most common thing. If that was going to somehow point to the New Testament, Christ and the church, do you see some significance there? Who did he come to save? John chapter 3 and verse 16. Hinted at by the very wood associated with what you find in the tabernacle. The gold. Also, you can begin to relate that to the New Testament. You've got a reference over in Hebrews chapter 2 and verse 9. The Bible there says Jesus was crowned with glory and honor. So this is just touching the hem of the garment. But as far as types and shadows indicating what was going to come, when you go back and you start studying the tabernacle, you could probably write an entire book on what that was and what it signified. And I'm not sure that even in our lifetime we'd be able to plumb all the different things associated with it. But certainly there are several that we can point out. Anything that you want to add or ask on what we've discussed so far? Okay, let's go back to Acts chapter 15 and kind of tie that up a little bit. As you look at verse 17, it says that this restored tabernacle, verse 16, was designed to help the residue of men. That's another way of describing the Gentiles. It also says that this residue of men, they wanted to seek the Lord. Well, again, they were interested in salvation. As I mentioned a moment ago, the ark pointed forward to that as you go back and you look at the acacia wood that was used. Peter, as we've noted before, had come to that conclusion about 10 years earlier at the household of Cornelius, and now this is not a new conclusion. They're simply reaffirming what he had stated on that occasion. Acts 15:18, the end of the verse says that it was God's plan to bring Gentiles into the church to be fellow heirs. That was no afterthought. Several times we've given the reference, Isaiah 46 and verse 10. Remember, God declares the end of something from when?
Beginning.
The beginning. So it's not that Jesus came and they were confused, heaven was confused about whether or not a kingdom was going to be established. God determined the best plan, and that plan was instituted, and it wasn't messed up in any way. Even before the creation of the earth, it was God's plan to bring all people together in one spiritual body. And the Old Testament, all kinds of hints, beginning in Genesis, going all the way through Malachi, telling us what was going to come through various types and shadows. So you have all that preceding information, part of the discussion, and you then get down to kind of the summation. That's where we'll, Lord willing, pick up next week. Moses' law agreed with what was written in the prophets. I think James uses probably the prophets to show that there were other men that also talked about this. You've got Isaiah's prophecy over in Isaiah chapter 2, where he talked about all nations going to the house of Jehovah and worshiping. There's also the prophecy over in Micah chapter 4, verses 1 through 4, about Gentiles, other nations coming into the house of God. But this was the kind of stuff, apparently, that was preached in the first century. They went back. And if you were a Jew, and you knew the Old Testament like the back of the hand, it's kind of like today. Somebody says, well, let's go over the ABCs. Well, okay, that's fine. I know them. What are you going to teach me about the ABCs? For the Jews, though, people like Paul were able to go back to the Old Testament, and maybe that's why he spent the 3 or so years in Arabia. God was saying, I'm going to help you connect the Old Testament with the New. And if you, they didn't have PowerPoint exactly back then, but if you are someone like that and you're able to go back to the Old Testament and say, let's talk about this and let's connect it to this. After you go through 5 or 10 of those, you're probably going to be thinking, oh, wow. And if you have a good and honest heart, you're going to stand up and say, you have the truth. Then you throw in with this kind of teaching, what else could Paul do? As an apostle, what else could Paul do? All right, he could do signs and wonders. You do a few signs and wonders, and then you stand up in the Saturday or Sunday morning Bible class, and you start laying this stuff out, and you're going to have some people respond to the gospel. They're going to say, I want to be baptized now. You have the truth. And I think that helps you to understand the excitement. Can you imagine if you'd been part of this Old Testament system, and even though you're not a priest, it's that cumbersome system, and a guy comes into town one day and says, you've been following this way. That was the old. Here's what it pointed forward to. Let me connect the dots. That, I think, helps explain why, as you look at the rapid spread of Christianity, especially among the Jews, it helps explain why so many of were converted, because they got it. Today, though, so many don't get it, because they have almost no knowledge of the Old Testament, and that's so sad. But if you go back and you start putting the two together, you begin to find some of the most amazing Bible study I think that you'll ever be involved with.